From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. The publication Investigate West has been exploring allegations of rape and sexual abuse by Idaho prison guards. Today, Owen Henderson talks with reporter Whitney Bryan about new developments in the investigation. We'll learn about the difficulties in getting information from the state about those cases. We spend time with Washington Lands Commissioner Dave Updegrove. He offers his thoughts about why the legislature should not cut his budgets for wildfire prevention and response and maintaining recreational areas. And Eliza Billingham asks Spokane author Maya Jules Zeller about her new memoir, Raised by Ferns. It's a series of essays about living in the Northwest and will be released next week. That's today's Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. Last fall, Investigate West published a series of stories that reported cases of rape and abuse by Idaho prison guards. It was called Guarded by Predators and alleged the correction system shields them from repercussions. Since then, the team at Investigate West has continued to follow the story as policymakers react and more details emerge. Today, Owen Henderson talks with investigative reporter Whitney Bryan.
So after that first series published, were you able to get back in contact with any of the women who shared their stories for the series? What did they think of the pieces?
Honestly, there's some mixed reviews. Many of the women thanked us for highlighting their perspectives, what was happening to them, taking them seriously. An issue that we spotted often in our original reporting was that people who were looking into these incidents were often responding to the victims of these assaults as if they were criminals rather than the victim of these newly reported crimes. The other piece of it is, you know, many of these women said, well, now it's out there, but nothing is changing. So now they fear retaliation of a different sort. They fear that other inmates are going to be mad at them because in some cases, inmates are getting things, you know, in exchange for these types of relationships. And now maybe that's going to start to subside a little bit. They are concerned that coworkers of some of the people who are being accused will hold grudges and treat them differently. So there is definitely a mix of gratefulness on these women's part, but also fear of retaliation moving forward.
And how about policymakers in Idaho? How did they react after the series published?
What we're hearing from lawmakers is that they're very concerned about one aspect of our reporting, which they have the most control over, really, which is that Idaho has one felony criminal law these abusers can be charged under. When a guard does commit an assault and prosecutors decide to charge them, there's this one law that they use to do that. Basically, it only allows charges to be filed for extremely serious assaults. It's required that penetration is involved in some way. So the reason that is problematic and narrow, according to experts, is we heard a lot of stories about women who were fondled over or under the clothing. But because the law doesn't specifically name that, these guards are often not charged for something that's a bit more minor. It has to really escalate before they can be charged. So what that means for lawmakers is they could change the existing law and expand it to include other types of abuse that could be prosecuted, or they could create, Washington and Oregon both have systems like this, where there's a misdemeanor law as well that protects inmates. We're hearing lawmakers are working with a local attorney on wording for a bill that would somehow adjust our laws here in Idaho. We don't yet know what that looks like.
Yeah, you've published now 7 stories since the original series came out, and those stories range from potential reforms, specific cases of abuse and reopening of investigations, and the roadblocks to tackling this systemic issue. What are some of the other ways that officials want to reform the state prison system?
Well, some of the other suggestions that we've heard are that the Department of Correction is revisiting its sexual misconduct policy. This is sort of a routine type of review. But in this case, that review happened to coincide with when we published our series. So the Department of Correction director, Bree Derrick, she came out in a public meeting and said, we're going to take some extra time looking over that sexual misconduct policy and ensuring that that policy reflects the culture that we want to present here, which of course is one of protecting inmates from abuse rather than allowing it to fester as it seems to have done so far. So I am hearing that that policy has been updated and that Department of Correction officers will start to receive training very soon in the changes to that policy. We have not seen the changes yet, so we're not sure what that looks like. One of the changes that we have seen so far, it might seem kind of minimal for some of our listeners because it really only affects one of the women that we talked to. But for her, this was monumental change. She had filed some complaints against multiple prison workers that were essentially ignored. Her case was reopened. They found evidence that they believe supported that she was telling the truth. So there is a little bit of movement. There's a lot of talk. And we will obviously continue to follow any real changes that occur. In terms of the roadblocks to making any real change in Idaho, financial blockades, of course, are always things that we're talking about when we're looking at government issues, but especially at the state level. Idaho is in a budget crunch, to say the least, right now. The legislature is currently meeting and trying to figure out how to fund vital services in the state. And one of the issues that I'm being told is coming up often is there's just not money to do anything new. So Idaho could, for instance, create an ombudsman's office to oversee some of these issues in the prisons at the state level, but that would cost money because it would be a new office that would need funding, and that's just not in the budget at the moment.
So your latest piece, which was co-reported with the Invisible Institute, what does this story deal with?
This story looks at a recent change that was made at the state level that is going to impact our ability to report these kinds of stories in the future. And also for the public and other research entities to hold accountable these officers who are accused of sexual abuse and other misconduct in the prison system. Last year, we were able to request through a public records request all the names of officers who had left the Department of Correction in the past decade. And we got their names, we got their positions, what prison they worked at, the date they were hired, the date they left, and very importantly, we got the reason that they left the department. It was vague, but basically told us whether officers were fired, whether they resigned, retired, some left for active military duty. Now these state officials are saying we're no longer going to release that reason for separation from a state agency. This information was vital to our reporting last year. It's what helped us learn not only who some of these officers were, but also that they were allowed to resign from the Department of Correction, leaving no trace in their employment history that they were accused of misconduct. So then when they go and apply for a job in another state at another prison, those departments of correction, let's say in Washington, for example, they would rely on public data so that they could call the Department of Correction in Idaho and say, we have a candidate applying for a job. He left the department last year. We want to know if he was fired or resigned from that position. Well, that information is no longer public to us to do that reporting, nor is it public for these other departments of correction. Criminal defense attorneys here in Idaho are saying this is extremely problematic and endangering to the public because they're using this type of information about law enforcement to defend their clients who may have experienced some of that misconduct from an officer. We're also hearing that this is going to hinder a lot of research that's being done nationally about what's called wandering cops. This is that phenomenon of an officer who commits misconduct at one jurisdiction, leaves that job and then gets a job at another jurisdiction and essentially keeps bouncing around because that misconduct is not being publicly provided. But the state is saying that their attorneys have reviewed the Public Records Act in Idaho, which has not changed, and that they're reinterpreting a clause to say that that information is not public and should be withheld.
Whitney Bryan is one of the journalists behind the series Guarded by Predators, which dives into allegations of rape and abuse by Idaho's prison guards and the system that shields them. You can find the stories on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. Whitney, thank you for your time and for sharing this reporting.
Thank you so much for having us.
Washington Lands Commissioner Dave Upthegrove was in Spokane this week. He stopped at Gonzaga University to talk with students about the world's changing climate and their role in dealing with it. And he met with us to talk about how to protect Department of Natural Resources lands at a time when the legislature is cutting budgets.
One of my top priorities in the legislature right now is to make sure legislators understand the impacts of their proposed cuts to our recreation programs. Both the House and the Senate budgets that were rolled out this last weekend include additional deep cuts to recreation maintenance. And if those aren't reversed through the budget process between now and the end of session, we're looking at closing about 10 or 11 recreation facilities and limiting the hours and services on many more. We have more than 20 million unique visits per year to our recreation sites. The public is going to feel those cuts if we don't find a way to work with the legislature to mitigate them in the next few weeks.
So you have legislators talking about, is that one of the priorities of government that should be spent? State money should be spent for that. How do you argue that?
Absolutely. Having a strong, clean, healthy environment and recreation opportunities contributes to the quality of life in this state. If we want to have good jobs and a strong economy, we need to keep Washington a great place to live. And people locate here, they bring jobs here, locate their businesses here because of that quality of life. People want to be able to go out and hunt and fish and hike and ride their horses, ride their motorcycles, and enjoy these lands that belong to all of us. And these are tremendous assets, and to not maintain them, to own as the public this tremendous resource and then not provide the funding to maintain it, to clear the trails when trees fall on them, to clean the bathrooms, to have a spot to park your car at the trailhead, to enforce the rules so people don't damage indigenous sites and cultural sites. And that takes money to maintain it. And that is a core function of government that contributes so much to our quality of life. Not just in rural areas, but people from suburban and urban areas flock to these recreation sites for their own well-being, for their families. It's one of the last affordable vacation things you can do as a family. It's an inexpensive, affordable recreation quality of life opportunity in this state that makes our state special. And it would be heartbreaking to see these opportunities get reduced at the same time the federal government is shutting down and restricting access on the federal lands in our state.
So speaking of budget cuts, you've also been making the case that we need to restore wildfire funding for the state of Washington. And it sounds like you've had some success. Tell me about kind of that challenge of making the case at a time when there's not enough money.
Yep. Last year, within days of being sworn into this office during the legislative session, the legislature cut our wildfire funding and prevention money in half, from $120 million over 2 years to $60 million. So that was a $60 million cut to wildfire prevention and response. I spent this summer on a mission, particularly in Western Washington, where the issue is not as salient. Up and down the I-5 corridor, meeting one-on-one with legislators, we built a big coalition of organizations to support us. And I'm very pleased to say that when the budgets came out this last week in both the House and the Senate, fully restored our $60 million in wildfire funding. And as long as that holds in both budgets, that's going to make a meaningful difference in our wildfire prevention response.
The fact that Western Washington has seen more wildfires, does that help make your case?
Everywhere I went in Western Washington, I reminded them we saw the largest number of fires start in Western Washington last year in history, and we had the largest fire in Western Washington in a generation with the Bear Gulch fire out on the Olympic Peninsula. And so I reminded folks this is an all of Washington problem, not just an Eastern Washington problem.
So given we've had a meager snowpack here in, especially in eastern Washington, northern Idaho, maybe a little bit better, do you have a wildfire forecast?
Snowpack itself is not an indicator of fire risk, but a low snowpack is one of the indicators of potential drought conditions. And the Department of Ecology works with an interagency group that Department of Natural Resources is part of to assess those drought conditions. And it's a little early in the season to have those assessments, but that group will look, and if we are at 75% or less of our usual moisture levels, and if we believe that's going to have an impact on water users, then the Department of Ecology will declare drought conditions. The drier things are, the higher the risk of fire, both in the short term with the lack of moisture on the landscape, but in the long term with the impact on the health of those forests. When you see trees die or be weaker and less resilient, then they attract disease, insect infestations. So I like to point out that a climate crisis drives a forest health crisis, drives a wildfire crisis. And we are seeing that over time, generally speaking. Drier conditions, less healthy forests, more wildfire risk.
Would you argue the state's in better shape because of the investments made the last few years that it, yes, you know, what could be a real bad year may not be as bad?
Yep. This wildfire prevention funding goes to things like forest health investments, where we clear out the underbrush and thin the forests. We will position equipment. We will purchase the equipment we need. We will give grants to local fire districts for training and for equipment. So all throughout the response system, this funding goes to work on our landscapes and to local partners. These fires are really expensive to put out. So if a fire starts and we can get there quickly with local partners, put it out before it's catastrophic, we save lots of money and we protect property.
Dave Up the Grove is Washington's elected lands commissioner. Maya Jules Zeller has spent most of her life trying to avoid telling her story. She grew up unconventionally, usually without a permanent mailing address or any understanding of trespassing laws. But she bristles at the suggestion she grew up homeless. Jules Zeller has spent plenty of her career writing. She's won awards for fiction and poetry. Fans kept asking her for longer stories that explored her personal insights on class, wealth, and privilege. Eventually, they got her to write her story down. In her debut memoir, Raised by Ferns, Jules Zeller uses ocean tides, exploding roadkill, and HOA bylaws to explore what poverty is and who gets to define it. SPR's Eliza Billingham talked with Jules Zeller before the book's release next week.
You talk a little bit in the book about feeling guilty about decisions that you've made now, living in an HOA, or having a garage door opener, or having a garage. Little tidbit for the listener, before we turned the microphones on, Maya and I were talking, and Maya just said, "Oh, I'm done with shame. I'm done with it." And I wonder how true that is, especially as you're going through these different systems, or you kind of have a foot in a mainstream experience and a not mainstream experience, and the shame that can come from feeling like you're not doing something right on either way. Have you navigated yourself out of that shame or guilt? Is it still a part of you? Do you think it should be?
This is like, you know, I feel like I'm on Oprah. So I think the answer to this question is sort of twofold. What do I believe about shame in general? And how do I cope with the question of, and the false question of, scare quotes, class transcendence, right? So in the book, I talk about privilege guilt. Like specifically, I use the word privilege guilt as a compound word. I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to say I coined it, but I haven't seen anyone else use privilege guilt as a word. And I think it's really easy to get stuck in privilege guilt and say, well, I feel bad because I have things that other people don't have. And do I still navigate that? Yes, every day, every day. And I have conversations with my children every day about what our privileges are. And I don't spend a lot of time in shame. I try to spend a lot of time in the impetus to action. So I, in the essays, when I talk about privilege guilt, it's interesting. I don't feel the way that I felt at the moment of writing that essay anymore. I feel more, I don't want to say empowered, but I feel an impetus toward empowerment to take action from the roles that I hold. So what that looks like and the way that shame has left me is I try, and again, I'm not going to virtue signal in this. I'm just going to say I try to do my best to actively participate in changing systems. So I'm an educator, and I spend a lot of time in the classroom talking about those systems and providing resources for learning more about ourselves. And I don't want, what I don't want is for my students with privilege or my children who have some privilege to walk around the world feeling shame because they were born with something that not all of their peers access. Instead, I would like them to have a sense of gentle, tender responsibility and to do something to try to redistribute resources. The arc of the book is you see the narrator grappling with the various privileges that she feels she has and realizing that she doesn't have as many as she thinks. She has more than she used to. And then she's still navigating a lot of things that by the end of the book, she loses some of those. Some of the access that she thinks she has in the beginning is very tenuous. And that's one of the wrestling tensions of the book is what is privilege? And not necessarily in terms of money.
Because there's a line in the book that says, you say something about the privilege of living where dirt isn't covered in concrete. Which I think you're pointing to the privilege of not growing up in the suburbs.
Right.
Something like that. What are ways to define privilege other than having money or not?
I think it's easy to talk about privilege in terms of money and power. It's also easy to forget that standing barefoot on grass is a privilege, or standing barefoot in mud is a privilege. And I don't want to enact a lensing of, oh, you're lucky if you get to live on dirt. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you're lucky if you get to access the earth. If you get to have a relationship, we throw around words like sustainability and regenerative and et cetera, et cetera. And I think a deep, intentional relationship with the natural world is the greatest privilege that any of us could have. My childhood had a lot of that. I had a lot of access to forest spaces, to public lands, and to private lands, on which as a child I trespassed with abandon because I didn't understand, you know, financial or county geographies the way that I understood the world the way that an animal understands it. So in the book, the title obviously is Raised by Ferns. And one of the jokes in the book is that I joke with my then husband. I joke that I don't understand American systems because I was raised by ferns. There are lots of gaps in our system. And one of those is that we don't have access to the natural world for everyone. And I would champion that as an access point above a lot of other things. I mean, I think everyone should be housed. Everyone should be fed and clothed. And everyone should have access to green spaces.
And you spend a lot of time in the classroom with students of various privileges. I bring that up because I think this next question came from, I should have written down the line that made me think of it, but I think it came from your experience in a classroom with students who maybe didn't realize that mm-hmm. you guys came from different socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Do you think having more money makes it harder to be empathetic to people in general, or especially to people who don't have that much money?
Ah, gosh, that's another really fun question. I don't actually think I can answer it fully. I've never had a lot of money. I've always been either working class or working middle class. And so without excess finances, I haven't really experienced that. You know, I haven't experienced that. The people I know who have more money or less money, I don't witness. And again, I think it would be interesting to do a sociological study on this, but I don't think that people with money don't have empathy. I think that there are people with empathy across all social strata. I think it's more about accessing arts and literacy, I think people with more access to arts are more empathetic. And that statistically is true. And that's why it's really important to have conversations and read and participate in all of the cultural activities that school systems and libraries and community centers and public radio provide. And that's why we need public radio and public libraries. I don't think that it's about having money. I think it's about having access to ideas.
Then I want to ask you about this Thoreau quote that you threw in at a point that I wasn't expecting it, and it kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I don't know if this is like asking someone to explain the punchline of a joke in a way that's like really not fun, but you throw this Thoreau quote in that says, "Cultivate poverty like a garden herb, like sage." Mm. What is he talking about? Why did you put that in?
It comes from the conclusion of his book, Walden. And if you've read Henry David Thoreau and you're a Thoreau scholar, you know, you kind of have to take everything in Walden with a fist of salt. Henry David Thoreau said at the beginning of Walden, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, and not when I came to die, realize I had not lived." That's a really bad paraphrase. But but he basically says that he went to the woods because he didn't want to live among the detritus of capitalism. And this was, you know, this was 150, 170 years ago. So when you think about Thoreau already recognizing things like, we do not ride upon the railroad, it rides upon us, or we have become tools of our tools, or like, those are things that Thoreau said. And one of the things that he said that I always found beautiful early on in reading him, and I first read Thoreau, I think when I was 17 or 18. So I was just encountering poverty studies, didn't even really know what it was, and was just realizing that I grew up in poverty because I didn't know that when I was a child. And when he said, "Cultivate poverty like a garden herb," I found it comforting because I thought, oh, good. this is one way that literature reaffirms rather than casting shame or a research eye on my youth. And so I first found that quote comforting. And reading Henry David Thoreau, I was comforted that someone would choose, like my parents had, choose to live outside of the systems. When he says that in the conclusion, he's giving, you know, when you read an argumentative essay, like an essay that's an argument, And you propose or reveal a social problem, you're supposed to, in the end on some step of action, right? If you're writing an argument essay for a class, for example. And his call to action is to cultivate poverty like a garden herb, not like something that is about not having what you need, but in the sense that something very small, like a sprig of sage, contains a lot of flavor. So poverty, like living simply, live simply that others may simply live, right? If you can live on less, then there's more for everyone else. So cultivating an herb garden, for example, in a tiny pot on your balcony in your apartment could give flavor to a lot of your life. You don't have to have whatever it is that takes you far, far into the other reaches where you access herbs. But I think that cultivating poverty like a garden herb is, what can you have around you that's the few things that you need that give you pleasure and joy and give value to your life, give meaning to your life?
That was Eliza Billingham and author Maya Jewell Zeller. Jewell Zeller's memoir, Raised by Ferns, will be released next Tuesday, March 3rd. The author will also host a launch party at the West Central Abbey, March 12th at 6:30 p.m. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. Today, we had most of the crew contributing. If you missed some or all of it, you can listen at SpokanePublicRadio.org. The radio airtimes are Thursday at 12:30, Saturday at 2:30, and you can check out Owen Henderson's SPR News Today podcast at our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Doug Nadvornik.